Coming up on today's episode...
You can be alive, but have you taken on your life? Those are very, very different things.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Disquieted Life with me, Emma Williams. In this podcast series, I'm drawing on my background in philosophy to explore the idea of mental health and how different writers, artists, and thinkers have approached and challenged the topic. Today I'll be talking to Sarah Beckwith about mental health and the work of William Shakespeare. Sarah is Catherine Everett Gilbert Professor of English, Theatre Studies and Religion at Duke University. In her work, she explores medieval and early modern drama and the philosophy of ordinary language. She's the author of the book Shakespeare and the Grammar of Forgiveness, essays such as Hamlet's Ethics, and she's currently working on the Book of Second Chances, a new work about versions of Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale. Hi, Sarah.
Hello, Emma. It's lovely to be with you.
Welcome to the podcast. Could we start off with you telling us a bit more about what led you into the kind of work that you do?
Well, I'm working, as you said, in America now, but you can hear from my voice that I'm a transplant from England, where I did my undergraduate degree and my PhD. And I started off doing a PhD in medieval literature because I became gripped and fascinated by the first women's writing in English. I had translated these texts during my undergraduate degree, fascinating what is known as anchoritic literature, which is literature written by women who hold themselves up, usually on the side of churches in these very small spaces, so that they could have access to church services. And it turned out that this is actually very, very generative of the first vernacular women's writing in England. And this was the setting that fascinated me. And I worked on a book that, when I was doing this, certainly was very little known. It's now a Penguin classic, of course. And that is a book called The Book of Marjory Kemp. She was a self-styled 15th century mystic, aspiring to be a saint. She had conversations with Julian of Norwich, who was this brilliant theologian who wrote a fascinating piece of theology called A Revelation of Divine Love. So really, I was very, very interested in the possibilities and conditions of women's expression and women's writing. And it was only later that I got into looking more concertedly at drama. I started working on these Corpus Christi mystery plays. And because they were suppressed during the Reformation, my work gradually pushed later and later. And I came, of course, perhaps almost inevitably, to Shakespeare. My first book on Shakespeare was a book on the late plays, which I call Shakespeare and the Grammar of Forgiveness.
Can you tell us why Shakespeare is interesting for us to look at in relation to mental health, given the time he was writing in was obviously quite different to the time we're in now?
The time that Shakespeare was writing was a time of enormous upheaval, particularly religious upheaval, because, of course, he lives just two or three generations beyond the English Reformation, when Henry VIII broke with the Roman Church in the mid-16th century in order to marry Anne Boleyn and divorce his wife, Catherine of Aragon. And after he died, his son, Edward VI, intensified the Protestantism of the English nation. Then we reverted back to Catholicism with Mary and back with Elizabeth I into, often known as perhaps erroneously, as a sort of middle way. England had, therefore, a very, very Protestant theology, but the vestiges of a bunch of Catholic institutions. Now, if you were, say, Shakespeare's father, John Shakespeare, the Glover in Stratford-upon-Avon, you would have found yourself overnight a treasonous subject of the crown. So indeed did everyone else, because as a Catholic, you are now no longer able to publicly express your religion. People who refused to go to the mandatory church services, which were Protestant theology and organized around Thomas Cranmer's Book of Common Prayer, were known as recusants, that they would recuse themselves from public services. So in a sense, the public expression for certain kinds of people, chiefly Catholics, but not exclusively Catholics, found themselves, if you like, without that possibility of public expression. All the public servants of the crown and those who held any kind of public office, jurors, teachers, civil servants, to use a slightly anachronistic term of any kind, would have had to have taken an oath of allegiance. This does create rather an extraordinary set of affairs where whatever you might have been feeling, as it were, in contravention of public orthodoxy was inexpressible. So there's a vast difference then, and a vast tension between the public expression of all kinds of things that might be very dearly held and what it is you might, as it were, be really feeling. It's a split between an inner and outer, if you like.
And that must have been a sort of source of real conflict then, that juxtaposition between the inner and outer, that idea that there's a sort of a public expression, but then a feeling that that's somehow at odds with something that you have.
I think very, very much so, a deep source of conflict and trouble. So I think it's very interesting to actually present it as a problem around a certain situation rather than a sort of a philosophy of some kind of sacred internal mind that actually can't be reached or can't be discovered. Certainly the state worried that it wasn't able to look into men and women's souls. Elizabeth famously said she would like to have a window on the soul. So the vocabulary of inner and outer also becomes quite widespread in a way.
And so then to turn to Shakespeare, this is something that he was exploring in his plays. One of the plays in particular is Hamlet. And I'm thinking of the sort of famous speech that they call the Seams speech.
Yes.
Could you tell us about the context for that in the play coming into this speech?
Definitely. So for people who don't know the play, we start on the battlements of a Danish castle in Elsinore, and it's very, very cold. There are guards. It's the changing of the guard. They're watching for danger. And these gentlemen, subsequently joined by Hamlet's best friend Horatio, see a ghost who departs when the cock crows. The ghost doesn't speak to them. It seems to be in the likeness of Hamlet's recently deceased father, the King of Denmark. And that is the very, very dramatic and in many ways very realistic opening first scene. And then we get a real juxtaposition of that in the second scene, because we have a very formal and ceremonious entrance. We have a court and we have the brother, who is now the king, the brother of old Hamlet, called Claudius. He has remarried Hamlet's mother rather quickly, according to Hamlet. So we're in a very, very formal, very, very public space. And Hamlet is famously wearing black. So it's as if this young man, who's recently lost his father, is going to insist on the ritual of mourning, which means the remembrance of his dead father. And it as something that needs to be remembered and indeed ritualized by the whole kingdom and by the court. Claudius is a brilliant politician. He gives a wonderful speech about how everybody is at peace and everyone has agreed to this marriage. But only Hamlet is standing sort of recalcitrantly, as it seems, to the court, in his black, at a distance, at odds. And his mother says, "Why do you keep looking for your noble father in the dust? You must know," she says, "that everyone who lives dies, and that we're all going to die. So essentially, what's your problem?" And she says something that seems to very much offend him. "Do not forever with thy veiled lids seek for thy noble father in the dust. Thou knowest 'tis common, all that lives must die, passing through nature to eternity." And Hamlet says, "Yes, madam, it is common." And it's something rather scornful he means by that. It's a commonplace, or yes, it's certainly common. And what sparks the Seams speech is Gertrude's question, "Why seems it so particular to thee?"
We have the context for the speech then. Let's have a listen to the actual speech itself.
"Seems, madam? Nay, it is. I know not seems. 'Tis not alone my inky cloak, good mother, nor customary suits of solemn black, nor windy suspiration of forced breath, no, nor the fruitful river in the eye, nor the dejected behaviour of the visage, together with all forms, moods, shapes of grief that can denote me truly, these indeed seem, for they are actions that a man might play. But I have that within which passeth show. These but the trappings and the suits of woe.
Well, thank you very much to the actor Jonathan Cullen for providing us with that wonderful reading of the speech. And we'll hear more from Jonathan a little later on in the episode. Sarah, can you tell us a bit about what's happening within the speech itself?
Yes. I mean, it's fascinating because this speech has prompted so much commentary. And for many people, it represents, if you like, the birth of this inner man, this inner person, what scholars like sometimes to call interiority. And they talk about this speech. It's the chief exhibit number one, the birth, if you like, of this dense inner psychology that is supposed to have been absent historically before. I don't agree with that reading at all, because I read drama as every line is motivated by exactly what somebody is saying right then and for what reason, to what person, and so on, that this is how we motivate the drama. And that there's a sense that I think that the speech makes much better sense when placed in its rightful context of an insist that this question is insulting. She's asking him, why seems it so particular to thee? Well, his father has just died. That is to say, Gertrude's husband has just died. And it's precisely that relationship that is not being recognized. So it's a sort of defensive retreat and a hidden plea for recognition. Because I feel that Hamlet is in some sense saying, well, here I am in black, adopting all the things that you do to show that you're in grief, which means that you're crying, you're wearing black, you're melancholy, you have a dejected visage, your eyes are fruitful rivers, and all the things that by and large we would understand as the expressions of grief. And she cannot accept them as expressions of grief, but he is simply some sort of irritant, if you like, to the smooth surface appearances of this ceremonial court, moving on, passing on, and they don't want to be interrupted by such a thing. So in a way, I feel Hamlet is in fact insisting on, yes, the particularity of his relationship with the father that he loved and mourned, and perhaps his relationship with his mother, which seems to be in tatters at this point, and at the same time, therefore retreating, because he can no longer assume that everything about him, his bodily expression, his comportment, his mood, all, as he calls it, the shapes of grief, are not being recognized or received by his mother. And this is a very different reading from imagining that there's something about the sanctity of an inner space that's historically inaugurated here.
So Hamlet is someone who's having these troubled feelings, dark and melancholy thoughts. In today's language, we might say that he's got an issue with his mental health. But what Shakespeare is doing isn't saying that the answer to that is to be found in some kind of introspective move or gaining some better understanding of what's going on inside us, in some space within us. What you're saying is that in this speech, Shakespeare's showing us that to think in that way that the idea that we should be introspecting and working out something going on inside of us,
yes,
is actually problematic.
Yes, and when we talk about mental health, that sort of attitude is, no matter how understandable, and I think we've all been to that space historically, and perhaps we do still go to it in our own defensive retreats, but it's going to be self-defeating. It is simply going to be self-defeating, isn't it? Because at that point, you are going to give up permanently, as it were, on the public expression. I won't even say public expression, simply on the expression of your emotion. That is to say, your very being. So the inner and the outer split, I think, is actually quite psychologically dangerous when used in this way. If we think we really do have that within which passes the show, it's going to be something that is liable to be self-defeating. It'll prevent us from the task, the work of finding a suitable expression, and therefore the very chance of having that received. Now, of course, it's natural that it's a risky thing. And Hamlet himself, as we go on to see, is in an entirely dangerous situation. So that one's expressions do and can put one at risk. They can expose one to the judgment of others. But that is how we are as expressive creatures, in a sense. So to decide that we somehow have that which simply can't be expressed is a self-defeating retreat, sadly, although an understandable one, I think.
Today, there's talk around expressing yourself, and it might be something that is taught, you know, skills and how to express yourself. But it seems like that idea of expression isn't quite getting to the picture that you're drawing for us.
Yes, I think that's very well said. And because in a way, it's not that you somehow know your own mind by looking inside you and there it all is. Actually, as a human being, you have to discover it just like anyone else. And it's a long drawn out and very interesting process, of course. I mean, it may well be the case that other people, perhaps to your chagrin, but other people might know you better than you know yourself. There's nothing guaranteed about the truth or the integrity of one's own self-knowledge. It's a task. And it's a task that only comes about through discovering yourself in expression, as it were, finding your voice, so that the voice is something to be found, not something that's already there. And it involves intrinsically other people. It's not discovered by, as it were, looking within, but rather by the kinds of exchanges that you've had as a social creature. Some philosophers talk about the second person comes before the first person, that you wouldn't be able to, as it were, say the I without the second person coming first, the you, that you are addressed by others around you always, so that the process, as it were, of exploring that first person voice is always done with others. The philosopher Wittgenstein put it rather wonderfully when he said the body is the best picture of the human soul. Our soulfulness comes through our capacity as expressive creatures.
So to come back to Hamlet and his defensive retreat, could we relate that to the sorts of strategies that people might engage in today?
There are so many ways to retreat, aren't there? We might hide in conformity. We might hide in simply going along with what everybody else thinks and failing to articulate our own differences and divergences. We might hide beneath certain forms of banality because we can't really abide our own differences from others. So I think there's multiple ways in which we might take this. I do think that the burdens now of social media make the manipulation of a public appearance extraordinarily difficult, because one's likely to imagine or assume that the world that someone is presenting, you know, their best picture on whatever a platform, Instagram or something, is the life they're living. And my life doesn't feel like that. My life doesn't feel as beautiful or as successful as that. And those, of course, this was such a huge topic of Shakespeare, the gap between appearance and reality. Now, if you like, technologically mediated in a really, really almost dangerous way. So it exacerbates, if you like, the problems that Shakespeare was elucidating in an altogether different era are still very, very, very present in that sense.
One of the key problems is to do with the sort of show and the appearance versus what's genuine. And that seems to be what Hamlet's grappling with in that speech. But the contrast we're setting up here isn't between the sort of outward and the inward. It's actually more, as you say, you can hide in conformity and you can hide in banality. It's more in the sort of meaning and what you're saying and your expression.
Hamlet, of course, has to spend a great deal of his life in the play hiding, because he soon realizes or suspects, but cannot know for sure, that his father has been murdered by Claudius. And he doesn't know whether his mother has known this or not. And that remains an enigma in the play. But his public expression of that insight would, and in fact eventually does in the play, put him in profound danger. And of course, what he does is he writes or adapts a play that depicts, that mirrors Claudius to himself, the murder of Gonzago. But that public expression, because he casts the murderer not as the brother to the king, but as a nephew to the king, which of course is exactly Hamlet's relation to Claudius. So the play that he writes the little insert for is both an accusation of murder and an invitation, perhaps witting or unwitting, to Claudius to think of him as somebody who will revenge that murder. What that does, of course, is to place him in extreme danger, because Claudius is now going to see him openly as his adversary. So even Hamlet's deflected play scripting, performed not by himself but by other actors, actually outs him and puts him at risk. And it doesn't quite have the effect that he thought it was going to have, which is to induce a confession of guilt, at least not openly. Claudius does confess his guilt, but he does it in a confessional scene where the only person on stage is, as he thinks, him and his maker.
So this is sort of leading us towards the ways that, as you said earlier as well, expression exposes us. We can never predict the outcomes, even though we might try and, as Hamlet's doing with the play, produce a certain effect. Actually, we'll always have consequences that go way beyond what we can control.
Exactly, because once we start thinking about ourselves as expressive creatures who say things to each other, that's because we have this extraordinary thing called language. When we say things to each other, the things we say to each other are inevitably actions in the world. I mean, we may not know, as exactly as you said, we may not know the effects of what those actions will be, but we have revealed ourselves, and we can't predict exactly what the response are going to be. Now in the play, the whole play is made up of people scripting roles for others. There's so many of them that are in some respects playwrights themselves, and there is a real juxtaposition between the idea of the revenge hero who scripts the part for his victim and nurtures it and brings it alive and wishes to reenact it. And Hamlet, most of the things in Hamlet simply happen by accident, and then he has to live with the consequences. And even the very last bit of the play, it's not necessarily at all obvious that he is revenging his father. He may just as well be understood to be revenging himself, or rather defending himself and revenging his mother. So even the act that Hamlet performs at the end, the killing of Claudius, is actually a very, very complex act indeed.
There are things that are unknown to us, and there may be motives and desires that we're suppressing or that we're not aware of, and so it's sort of misleading to think that it's possible to trace things back to one interpretation that we can give.
Yes, exactly. And I think you're right that the idea of the unknownness of things is a huge idea in Hamlet, and if anything, he goes into that last scene, because Horatio says, "Don't do it, man. You're really out of shape. You're not going to, this is going to be a disaster." And Hamlet just says, I'm ready. I mean, he puts it much more beautifully than that. If it be now, it is not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. So he's going to die at some point. All you can do, he's saying to himself, is be ready. Be as ready as you can be for the unexpected. And this is obviously so different from the attempt to script and control. He's given up that fantasy, I think, at this stage completely. Really interesting that it's almost as if he has to be able to accept the possibility of his own mortality in order to be able to really announce himself as he does. He does declare himself very forthrightly after all of the secrecy and the feigning madness in the play. He does declare himself, I am Hamlet the Dane. He comes back and he also declares his love for Ophelia, which is not something that I think he has done before.
And what happens here in Hamlet seems to me then a very good picture of the idea of the disquieted life. Hamlet only stops hiding and opens himself to the possibility of love, ultimately, through the acknowledgement of his finitude, through the acknowledgement of the uncertainty and the unknown conditions of human life, of the very nature of human life as disquieted. But just to think a bit more about that idea that our lives are disquieted, some might think that's a depressing idea of the human condition. Is it depressing?
In a sense, I feel like it's not that the idea is either depressing or exhilarating, but rather what it is. That's, I think, why perhaps Hamlet's acceptance of his own, in this case, it's his mortality, accepting certain things about the way we are as human creatures means in the end having to accept your own separateness from others. So I think these are simply huge tasks in any human life. They seem so obvious and so simple that you accept that you're separate. But for most people, that's a real journey.
Your separateness means it's not possible to just kind of fall back on stop formula for how you know the best way to live or for what you should do. It's that it's a task that you need to take on for yourself.
There are all kinds of directions one can give people for, you know, I can tell you how to make a polenta, an orange cake or something, but I can't tell you even whether a decision that's important to you is right for you. It would be coercive, it would be wrong for me to think that I know what's best for you in these kinds of areas. These are sort of ethical areas, aren't they? The direction of one's life won't be clear to me, and it may not be clear to you, but it's for you to find out. And that, I think, is exactly as you said, it's to do with simply the responsibility of taking on. Your word was a very good one, taking on, because you can be alive, but have you taken on your life? Those are very, very different things.
What do you think about the idea of mental health? I bring it in here in that it seems to suggest a certain kind of serenity, which doesn't really seem to fit.
I think it's so interesting because you can imagine, if you talk about physical health, you can imagine, you know, an athlete who's training for the 100 meters or a marathon runner or a, you know, tip-top tennis player or something. And you can legitimately say they're in amazing physical health, and then the rest of us are jogging along. But the idea that there's any state of, even a state of perfection that you're moving towards, it just doesn't really work, or any obvious path to get there, or any sense that perfect calm can ever be reached in life. I mean, maybe if you're a Stoic philosopher, you can fantasize that you can reach that, or a Zen monk who might spend years attempting to reach such a state. But the idea that there's this static place where we can be pronounced, as it were, a mentally healthy human being, it sort of denies the minute vagaries of one's own, not just mental life, but mental life obviously is just connected with your physical, social, and spiritual life, if you like.
I suppose the very idea of mental,
yes,
in that health,
it's sort of based on that mind-body split, in a way, that based on the mind-body split that we've been alluding to perhaps throughout, in a way. Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And so it's going to lead to quite problematic conceptions.
Yes, and one of them being perhaps that the mind is just reducible to the brain. So in order to understand how your mind works, you simply need to turn to somebody who studies the brain, like a neuroscientist, for example. The picture that the neuroscientist might give us of the way that our minds and our brains work doesn't account for the kinds of things we've been talking about, expression and the nature of the human being as an expressive being.
Exactly, because it might be a temptation, as you said, with the neuroscientist, to a certain kind of scientism. So you can just bypass, you just look at brain images or brain patterns and bypass the sort of effortful ways in which we do try to find our directions or our paths, or we do try to find meaning in our own lives.
Does that help us to see why Shakespeare and, you know, not just Hamlet as a play, but other plays too, can help us to think about mental health in a more critical way.
Yes, because in a way, his great gift to us was to so thoroughly plumb those human and expressive resources, and to do so, obviously, in a language that was becoming more and more rich and diverse, and as the inheritor of an educational training that stressed things like rhetoric and so on, he inherited this sense of public language, if you like, but his own ways of being able to plumb the expressive resources of that language and attach them to individual people who were permanently changing and transforming themselves by virtue of the spoken word. That I think is a kind of a permanent gift, if you like. I think his plays do certainly chart forms of healing. For example, a play like King Lear, written a few years after Hamlet, what happens when love can't be expressed, or when people confuse love with flattery? That's the opening scene of King Lear. And of course, it leads to these absolutely catastrophic consequences. It leads to a broken family, a civil war. And so I think, in a sense, Shakespeare takes very, very seriously what it might mean for, in this case, the love of a daughter for her father, to not be expressible, to be misrecognized or misconceived as a form of flattery, say. So, I mean, what he's suggesting, I think, is that the kinds of self-knowledge and knowledge of others available to you that emerges out of such expressions will be so brutally truncated as to lead to the kinds of pain and indeed viciousness of that play. So it's very serious. In the tragic idiom, this is incredibly, incredibly serious. And you get the portrayal of these figures, that usually masculine figures, who think that language begins and ends with them, that their word is everything, that therefore they can speak for others. Those two come to tragic ends. That is going to be a tragic story for Shakespeare, the idea that with all the power in the world, a Coriolanus or a King Lear or a Timon can, or a Leontes in The Winter's Tale, can simply say how the world is and can speak for others, tell them what they are.
But I guess this also means that to say there's a theme of healing within Shakespeare's later plays doesn't mean his plays are giving us the cure or a final answer to the problems that we face as human beings.
That's right. Because the difference between these late plays and the way they end, they're not happy endings because nothing's finally ended. The play's formally ended. But the mood of those late plays is that actually anything could go wrong at any point. They're terribly fragile. So they accept all the things that we've been talking about. They accept certain kinds of risk and exposure. They accept certain kinds of necessities that come about from the way we act towards each other. And they accept the unpredictability and the unknownness, I think, of that way of life. And therefore, they're delicate. The endings are a delicate balance. They're fragile. And I think we're left with those plays as that's a fragility we need to honor and treasure and work towards, because it's liable to breakage at any point, really.
And this helps us to see the relevance of Shakespeare's message and what we find in Shakespeare's literature to our lives and our existences today in the modern world. And it helps us to see the real importance there is in people having the opportunity to hear that message. To look at Shakespeare in education would be an opportunity for young people to learn about the disquieted life, a different picture of life to what they might find and might be given through social media, representations, etc. Young people should be given the opportunity to learn about these ideas and this way of thinking about the world and understanding the human condition.
Well, I will say that the way in which, let's say, drama at school might be regarded as a luxury, and the way that the arts might be the first thing to be cut this is a very wrong way of going about things. If one wants to nurture mental health, I think that drama is an astonishing place for exploration. Shakespeare, I happen to think, is extraordinarily rich in that regard. But the idea, again, because you're playing with precisely the full expressive resources, and you're trying things out. Lots of these dramas are thought experiments. This is why Shakespeare is used in many, many prison programs across the United States. There are some extremely well-regarded arts programs. It's interesting to note the recidivism rate of some of those very successful programs, like those, for example, of a wonderful theatre director called Kurt Toffland, which has been the subject of a wonderful documentary called Shakespeare Behind Bars. The recidivism rate is much, much lower than for other incarcerated folk who may not have access to those programs. So that's a stress on rehabilitation and repair, rather than, say, punishment, where the results in terms of the growth and possibilities for self-education are enormous. And I think particularly for school age and for teenagers and preteens, the role of the arts is a place of exploration and possibility. So it's not that sort of reading Shakespeare makes you a better person or anything like that, but rather that the modes of possibility and discovery, apart from sheer fun, and it's a world of trying things out. It's just like in Shakespeare's earlier plays, it's like the trouser roles for the women. I mean, they're boy actors, of course, in Shakespeare's time, but you get to see, you know, what's it like being in a different body? Being in a different class, being in a different country, you get to explore a range of possibilities. And so that brings, with good teachers and so on, that brings forms of liberation that come through play and only through play.
So earlier on in the podcast, we heard the actor Jonathan Cullen reading us the wonderful Seems speech from Hamlet. And we thought it'd be really interesting to ask him, in relation to what we're talking about his perspective on drama and theatre and what he takes from being an actor and from his experience of acting.
My name's Jonathan Cullen and I'm a professional actor. I've been an actor for many years now. And I suppose what fascinates me about it is the interchange between yourself and the audience, for one thing. There's a sense in which, why do we go to the theatre? We go to be seen somehow. It's rather like the therapeutic interaction whereby a therapist will summarise and feed back what they're hearing, and the person who's on the couch will feel validated, will feel as though they matter, which is really all that we want in life, I guess. And so I think when I go to the theatre or when I'm up on the stage, there's this interchange between us where you say, this is us, here we are in all our variety with our hopes and our fears represented up here. You're not alone. In fact, you're sitting there in this strange collectivity of an audience. And up there in your very public solitude as an actor, you're trying to engage with them. And this ties in with advice, I guess, that I was given very early on as a young actor. I was so focused on myself and what I was doing and prone to making a judgment about the character I was playing and basically acting them in inverted commas, so to speak. And somebody said to me, never judge, always justify. And I've tried to hold that as my motto when I'm preparing a character ever since, to find what there is of God, what there is of hope, what there is savable, what's human about this person that you're trying to be and represent. Nobody else is going to fight their corner. And it's your sole job, really, to fight their corner. So whether they're a good or a bad person, you're trying to do that. And that applies to tragedy as well as comedy, actually. In comedy, you're also looking for what it is they're hoping for, what they're trying to do, what they expect of life. Usually in comedy, there's a radical mismatch between this and what they actually manage to achieve. But there again, that's so like life. And there again, the audience can laugh at this incongruity, I suppose.
What Jonathan's saying there very much seems to fit with this picture of drama as a space of play and a space of expression. Even as Jonathan talks about there, theatre can be a therapeutic experience itself. But to think about these values that we're talking about in drama, they're not the sorts of things that are straightforwardly quantifiable. They don't really fit with the model of education where you've got a sort of defined outcome at the end that you're trying to get to.
That's right. And it's hard to capture with the sort of rather truncated way in which the bureaucracy of education has narrowed and reduced these possibilities. It's made, you want to talk about expression, it's made what we're talking about harder to actually encompass because those very categories, if you like, have not really taken on board the full possibilities for, say, drama, for the arts, and for education.
It seems like there's already an idea of what the person is that you need to get to at the end, rather than it being actually the process through which you might discover who you're going to be.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because in some ways I think that's probably what humanist thought rhetoric was going to be in the 16th century, that you produce future scholars and public people and so on who could speak well. But then you had this explosion of people, often the sons of artisans, of like Shakespeare was himself, who didn't go to university, but who, in a way, had a training that they therefore transformed in this new public space of a theatre, where you got to play a role on different nights in these new institutions of the public theatres in the late 16th century.
Well, that's almost all we have time for. But to play us out, we're going to hear Jonathan reading a speech from later on in Hamlet. In fact, we're going to hear Jonathan read the speech twice. As you listen, try to think about how the differences in tone and phrasing alter the effect of the speech. What's Hamlet thinking? What's he trying to say? What's motivating what he says? The differences in the readings give us further food for thought on the issues around expression we've been discussing in this episode. There's also a very slight, though significant, difference in the wording at the very end of the two readings. The first follows the standard version of Shakespeare's text, and the second uses what's known as the folio version. But before we get on to that, thank you very much to you, Sarah.
Thank you so much. I've really thoroughly enjoyed it.
The speeches you're about to hear come from Act 5, Scene 2. This is the final act of the play. Hamlet has by this point killed Polonius by mistake while acting mad, and his behaviour has contributed to Ophelia committing suicide. The following speech is delivered by Hamlet to Laertes, who is Ophelia's brother and Polonius's son. Is the speech an expression of Hamlet's inner turmoil, or an attempt to use his madness as an evasion of responsibility for what's happened?
Give me your pardon, sir. I have done you wrong, but pardon it as you are a gentleman. This presence knows, and you must needs have heard, how I am punished with sore distraction. What I have done, that might your nature, honour, and exception roughly awake, I here proclaim was madness. Was it Hamlet wronged Laertes? Never Hamlet. If Hamlet from himself be ta'en away, and when he's not himself, does wrong Laertes, then Hamlet does it not. Hamlet denies it. Who does it, then? His madness, if it be so. Hamlet is of the faction that is wronged. His madness is poor Hamlet's enemy. Sir, in this audience, let my disclaiming from a purposed evil free me so far in your most generous thoughts that I have shot my arrow o'er the house and hurt my brother. Give me your pardon, sir. I've done you wrong. But pardon it, as you are a gentleman. This presence knows, and you must needs have heard, how I am punished with sore distraction. What I have done, that might your nature, honour, and exception roughly awake, I here proclaim was madness. Was it Hamlet wronged Laertes? Never Hamlet. if Hamlet from himself be ta'en away, and when he's not himself does wrong Laertes, then Hamlet does it not. Hamlet denies it. Who does it then? His madness? If it be so, Hamlet is of the faction that is wronged. His madness is poor Hamlet's enemy. Sir, in this audience, let my disclaiming from a purposed evil free me so far in your most generous thoughts that I have shot mine arrow o'er the house and hurt my mother.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to know more about the ideas we've discussed, please check out the show notes on the podcast website. Join us again next time for more discussion of philosophy and the disquieted life.